Benevolence and generosity are virtues, and without private property they are impossible. Finally, we are told that if Plato's plans were good, someone would have thought of them sooner. Footnote. Compare the Noodles Oration in Sidney Smith. If the proposal be sound, would the Saxon have passed it by? Would the Dane have ignored it? Would it have escaped the wisdom of the Norman? I quote from memory. End of footnote. I do not agree with Plato, but if anything could make me do so, it would be Aristotle's arguments against him. As we have seen in connection with slavery, Aristotle is no believer in equality. Granted, however, the subjection of slaves and women, it still remains a question whether all citizens should be politically equal. Some men, he says, think this is desirable on the ground that all revolutions turn on the regulation of property. He rejects this argument, maintaining that the greatest crimes are due to excess rather than want. No man becomes a tyrant in order to avoid feeling the cold. A government is good when it aims at the good of the whole community, bad when it cares only for itself. There are three kinds of government that are good: monarchy, aristocracy, and constitutional government, or polity. There are three that are bad: tyranny, oligarchy, and democracy. There are also many mixed intermediate forms. It will be observed that the good and bad governments are defined by the ethical qualities of the holders of power, not by the form of the constitution. This, however, is only partly true. An aristocracy is a rule of men of virtue, an oligarchy is a rule of the rich, and Aristotle does not consider virtue and wealth strictly synonymous. What he holds, in accordance with the doctrine of the golden mean, is that a moderate competence is most likely to be associated with virtue. Mankind do not acquire or preserve virtue by the help of external goods, but external goods by the help of virtue and happiness, whether consisting in pleasure or virtue, or both, is more often found with those who are most highly cultivated in their mind and in their character, and have only a moderate share of external goods, than among those who possess external goods to a useless extent, but are deficient in higher qualities. There is therefore a difference between the rule of the best, aristocracy, and of the richest, oligarchy, since the best are likely to have only moderate fortunes. There is also a difference between democracy and polity. In addition to the ethical difference in the government, for what Aristotle calls polity retains some oligarchic elements. But between monarchy and tyranny, the only difference is ethical. He is emphatic in distinguishing oligarchy and democracy by the economic status of the governing party. There is oligarchy when the rich govern without consideration for the poor, democracy when power is in the hands of the needy and they disregard the interests of the rich. Monarchy is better than aristocracy. Aristocracy is better than polity. But the corruption of the best is worst. Therefore, tyranny is worse than oligarchy, and oligarchy than democracy. In this way, Aristotle arrives at a qualified defense of democracy. For most actual governments are bad, and therefore among actual governments, democracies tend to be best. The Greek conception of democracy was in many ways more extreme than ours. For instance, Aristotle says that to elect magistrates is oligarchic, while it is democratic to appoint them by lot. In extreme democracies, the assembly of the citizens was above the law and decided each question independently. The Athenian law courts were composed of a large number of citizens chosen by lot, unaided by any jurist. They were, of course, liable to be swayed by eloquence or party passion. When democracy is criticized, it must be understood that this sort of thing is meant. There is a long discussion of causes of revolution. In Greece, revolutions were as frequent as formerly in Latin America, and therefore Aristotle had a copious experience from which to draw inferences. The main cause was the conflict of oligarchs and democrats. Democracy, Aristotle says, arises from the belief that men who are equally free should be equal in all respects. Oligarchy, from the fact that men who are superior in some respect claim too much. Both have a kind of justice, but not the best kind. Therefore, both parties, whenever their share in the government does not accord with their preconceived ideas, stir up revolution. Democratic governments are less liable to revolutions than oligarchies, because oligarchs may fall out with each other. The oligarchs seem to have been vigorous fellows. In some cities, we are told, they swore an oath, I will be an enemy to the people, and will devise all the harm against them which I can. Nowadays, reactionaries are not so frank. The three things needed to prevent revolution are government propaganda in education, respect for law, even in small things, and justice in law and administration, that is, equality according to proportion, and for every man to enjoy his own. Aristotle never seems to have realized the difficulty of equality according to proportion. If this is to be true justice, the proportion must be of virtue. Now, virtue is difficult to measure, and is a matter of party controversy. In political practice, therefore, virtue tends to be measured by income. The distinction between aristocracy and oligarchy, which Aristotle attempts to make, is only possible where there is a very well-established hereditary nobility. Even then, as soon as there exists a large class of rich men who are not noble, they have to be admitted to power for fear of their making a revolution. Hereditary aristocracies cannot long retain their power except where land is almost the only source of wealth. All social inequality in the long run is inequality of income. That is part of the argument for democracy, that the attempt to have a proportionate justice based on any merit other than wealth is sure to break down. Defenders of oligarchy pretend that income is proportional to virtue. The prophet said he had never seen a righteous man begging his bread, and Aristotle thinks that good men acquire just about his own income, neither very large nor very small. But such views are absurd. Every kind of justice other than absolute equality will, in practice, reward some quality quite other than virtue, and is therefore to be condemned. There is an interesting section on tyranny. A tyrant desires riches, whereas a king desires honour. The tyrant has guards who are mercenaries, whereas the king has guards who are citizens. Tyrants are mostly demagogues, who acquire power by promising to protect the people against the notables. In an ironically Machiavellian tone, Aristotle explains what a tyrant must do to retain power. He must prevent the rise of any person of exceptional merit by execution or assassination if necessary. He must prohibit common meals, clubs, and any education likely to produce hostile sentiment. There must be no literary assemblies or discussions. He must prevent people from knowing each other well and compel them to live in public at his gates. He should employ spies like the female detectives at Syracuse. He must sow quarrels and impoverish his subjects. He should keep them occupied in great works, as the king of Egypt did in getting the pyramids built. He should give power to women and slaves to make them informers. He should make war in order that his subjects may have something to do and be always in want of a leader. It is a melancholy reflection that this passage is, of the whole book, the one most appropriate to the present day. Aristotle concludes that there is no wickedness too great for a tyrant. There is, however, he says, another method of preserving a tyranny, namely by moderation and by seeming religious. There is no decision as to which method is likely to prove the more successful. There is a long argument to prove that foreign conquest is not the end of the state, showing that many people took the imperialist view. There is, it is true, an exception. Conquest of natural slaves is right and just. This would, in Aristotle's view, justify wars against barbarians, but not against Greeks, for no Greeks are natural slaves. In general, war is only a means, not an end. A city in an isolated situation where conquest is not possible may be happy. States that live in isolation need not be inactive. God and the universe are active, though foreign conquest is impossible for them. The happiness that a state should seek, therefore, though war may sometimes be a necessary means to it, should not be war, but the activities of peace. This leads to the question, how large should a state be? Large cities, we are told, are never well governed, because a great multitude cannot be orderly. A state ought to be large enough to be more or less self-sufficing, but not too large for constitutional government. It ought to be small enough for the citizens to know each other's characters, otherwise right will not be done in elections and lawsuits. The territory should be small enough to be surveyed in its entirety from a hilltop. We are told both that it should be self-sufficient and that it should have an export and import trade, which seems an inconsistency. Men who work for their living should not be admitted to citizenship. Citizens should not lead the life of mechanics or tradesmen, for such a life is ignoble and inimical to virtue. Nor should they be husbandmen, because they need leisure. The citizens should own the property, but the husbandmen should be slaves of a different race. Northern races, we are told, are spirited. Southern races, intelligent. Therefore, slaves should be of southern races, since it is inconvenient if they are spirited. The Greeks alone are both spirited and intelligent. They are better governed than barbarians, and if united, could rule the world. One might have expected at this point some allusion to Alexander, but there is none. With regard to the size of states, Aristotle makes, on a different scale, the same mistake that is made by many modern liberals. A state must be able to defend itself in war, and even, if any liberal culture is to survive, to defend itself without very great difficulty. How large this requires a state to be depends upon the technique of war and industry. In Aristotle's day, the city-state was obsolete because it could not defend itself against Macedonia. In our day, Greece as a whole, including Macedonia, is obsolete in this sense, as has been recently proved. Footnote. This was written in May 1941. End of footnote. To advocate complete independence for Greece or any other small country is now as futile as to advocate complete independence for a single city, whose territory can be seen entire from an eminence. There can be no true independence except for a state or alliance strong enough, by its own efforts, to repel all attempts at foreign conquest. Nothing smaller than America and the British Empire combined will satisfy this requirement, and perhaps even this would be too small a unit. The book, which in the form in which we have it appears to be unfinished, ends with a discussion of education. Education, of course, is only for children who are going to be citizens. Slaves may be taught useful arts, such as cooking, but these are no part of education. The citizen should be moulded to the form of government under which he lives, and there should therefore be differences, according as the city in question is oligarchic or democratic. In the discussion, however, Aristotle assumes that the citizens will all have a share of political power. Children should learn what is useful to them, but not vulgarizing. For instance, they should not be taught any skill that deforms the body, or that would enable them to earn money. They should practice athletics in moderation, but not to the point of acquiring professional skill. The boys who train for the Olympic Games suffer in health, as is shown by the fact that those who have been victors as boys are hardly ever victors as men. Children should learn drawing in order to appreciate the beauty of the human form, and they should be taught to appreciate such painting and sculpture as expresses moral ideas. They may learn to sing and to play musical instruments enough to be able to enjoy music critically, but not enough to be skilled performers, for no free man would play or sing unless drunk. They must, of course, learn to read and write, in spite of the usefulness of these arts. But the purpose of education is virtue, not usefulness. What Aristotle means by virtue, he has told us in the Ethics, to which this book frequently refers. Aristotle's fundamental assumptions in his Politics are very different from those of any modern writer. The aim of the state, in his view, is to produce cultured gentlemen, men who combine the aristocratic mentality with love of learning and the arts. This combination existed in its highest perfection in the Athens of Pericles, not in the population at large, but among the well-to-do. It began to break down in the last years of Pericles. The populace, who had no culture, turned against the friends of Pericles, who were driven to defend the privileges of the rich by treachery, assassination, illegal despotism, and other such not very gentlemanly methods. After the death of Socrates, the bigotry of the Athenian democracy diminished, and Athens remained the centre of ancient culture, but political power went elsewhere. Throughout later antiquity, power and culture were usually separate. Power was in the hands of rough soldiers. Culture belonged to powerless Greeks, often slaves. This is only partially true of Rome in its great days, but it is emphatically true before Cicero and after Marcus Aurelius. After the barbarian invasion, the gentlemen were northern barbarians, the men of culture, subtle southern ecclesiastics. This state of affairs continued more or less until the Renaissance, when the laity began to acquire culture. From the Renaissance onwards, the Greek conception of government by cultured gentlemen gradually prevailed more and more, reaching its acme in the 18th century. Various forces have put an end to this state of affairs. First, democracy, as embodied in the French Revolution and its aftermath. The cultured gentlemen, as after the age of Pericles, had to defend their privileges against the populace, and in the process ceased to be either gentlemen or cultured. A second cause was the rise of industrialism, with a scientific technique very different from traditional culture. A third cause was popular education, which conferred the power to read and write, but did not confer culture. This enabled a new type of demagogue to practice a new type of propaganda, as seen in the dictatorships. Both for good and evil, therefore, the day of the cultured gentleman is past. Chapter 22. Aristotle's Logic. Aristotle's influence, which was very great in many different fields, was greatest of all in logic. In late antiquity, when Plato was still supreme in metaphysics, Aristotle was the recognized authority in logic, and he retained this position throughout the Middle Ages. It was not till the 13th century that Christian philosophers accorded him supremacy in the field of metaphysics. This supremacy was largely lost after the Renaissance, but his supremacy in logic survived. Even at the present day, all Catholic teachers of philosophy, and many others, still obstinately reject the discoveries of modern logic, and adhere with a strange tenacity to a system which is as definitely antiquated as Ptolemaic astronomy. This makes it difficult to do historical justice to Aristotle. His present-day influence is so inimical to clear thinking that it is hard to remember how great an advance he made upon all his predecessors, including Plato, or how admirable his logical work would still seem if it had been a stage in a continual progress, instead of being, as in fact it was, a dead end, followed by over 2,000 years of stagnation. In dealing with the predecessors of Aristotle, it is not necessary to remind the reader that they are not verbally inspired. One can therefore praise them for their ability without being supposed to subscribe to all their doctrines. Aristotle, on the contrary, is still, especially in logic, a battleground, and cannot be treated in a purely historical spirit. Aristotle's most important work in logic is the doctrine of the syllogism. A syllogism is an argument consisting of three parts: a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. Syllogisms are of a number of different kinds, each of which has a name, given by the scholastics. The most familiar is the kind called Barbara. All men are mortal, major premise. Socrates is a man, minor premise. Therefore, Socrates is mortal, conclusion. Or, all men are mortal, all Greeks are men, therefore, all Greeks are mortal. Aristotle does not distinguish between these two forms. This, as we shall see later, is a mistake. Other forms are, no fishes are rational, all sharks are fishes, therefore no sharks are rational. This is called celerent. All men are rational, some animals are men, therefore some animals are rational. This is called derii. No Greeks are black, some men are Greeks, therefore some men are not black. This is called Ferio. These four make up the first figure. Aristotle adds a second and third figure, and the schoolmen added a fourth. It is shown that the three later figures can be reduced to the first by various devices. There are some inferences that can be made from a single premise. From some men are mortal, we can infer that some mortals are men. According to Aristotle, this can also be inferred from all men are mortal. From no gods are mortal, we can infer no mortals are gods. But from some men are not Greeks, it does not follow that some Greeks are not men. Apart from such inferences as the above, Aristotle and his followers thought that all deductive inference, when strictly stated, is syllogistic. By setting forth all the valid kinds of syllogism, and setting out any suggested argument in syllogistic form, it should therefore be possible to avoid all fallacies. This system was the beginning of formal logic, and as such was both important and admirable. But considered as the end, not the beginning of formal logic, it is open to three kinds of criticism. 1. Formal defects within the system itself. 2. Overestimation of the syllogism as compared to other forms of deductive argument. 3. Overestimation of deduction as a form of argument. On each of these three, something must be said. 1. Formal defects. Let us begin with the two statements, Socrates is a man and all Greeks are men. It is necessary to make a sharp distinction between these two, which is not done in Aristotelian logic. The statement, all Greeks are men, is commonly interpreted as implying that there are Greeks. Without this implication, some of Aristotle's syllogisms are not valid. Take, for instance, all Greeks are men, all Greeks are white, therefore some men are white. This is valid if there are Greeks, but not otherwise. If I were to say, all golden mountains are mountains, all golden mountains are golden, therefore some mountains are golden, my conclusion would be false, though in some sense my premises would be true. If we are to be explicit, we must therefore divide the one statement, all Greeks are men, into two. One saying, there are Greeks, and the other saying, if anything is a Greek, it is a man. The latter statement is purely hypothetical and does not imply that there are Greeks. The statement, all Greeks are men, is thus much more complex in form than the statement, Socrates is a man. Socrates is a man has Socrates for its subject, but all Greeks are men does not have all Greeks for its subject, for there is nothing about all Greeks, either in the statement, there are Greeks, or in the statement, if anything is a Greek, it is a man. This purely formal error was a source of errors in metaphysics and theory of knowledge. Consider the state of our knowledge in regard to the two propositions, Socrates is mortal and all men are mortal. In order to know the truth of Socrates is mortal, most of us are content to rely upon testimony. But if testimony is to be reliable, it must lead us back to someone who knew Socrates and saw him dead. The one perceived fact, the dead body of Socrates, together with the knowledge that this was called Socrates, was enough to assure us of the mortality of Socrates. But when it comes to all men are mortal, the matter is different. The question of our knowledge of such general propositions is a very difficult one. Sometimes they are merely verbal. All Greeks are men is known because nothing is called a Greek unless it is a man. Such general statements can be ascertained from the dictionary. They tell us nothing about the world except how words are used. But all men are mortal is not of this sort. There is nothing logically self-contradictory about an immortal man. We believe the proposition on the basis of induction, because there is no well-authenticated case of a man living more than, say, 150 years. But this only makes the proposition probable, not certain. It cannot be certain so long as living men exist. Metaphysical errors arose through supposing that all men is the subject of all men are mortal, in the same sense as that in which Socrates is the subject of Socrates is mortal. It made it possible to hold that, in some sense, all men denotes an entity of the same sort as that denoted by Socrates. This led Aristotle to say that, in a sense, a species is a substance. He is careful to qualify this statement, but his followers, especially Porphyry, showed less caution. Another error into which Aristotle falls through this mistake is to think that a predicate of a predicate can be a predicate of the original subject. If I say, Socrates is Greek, all Greeks are human, Aristotle thinks that human is a predicate of Greek, while Greek is a predicate of Socrates, and obviously human is a predicate of Socrates. But in fact, human is not a predicate of Greek. The distinction between names and predicates, or in metaphysical language, between particulars and universals, is thus blurred, with disastrous consequences to philosophy. One of the resulting confusions was to suppose that a class with only one member is identical with that one member. This made it impossible to have a correct theory of the number one, and led to endless bad metaphysics about unity. 2. Overestimation of the syllogism. The syllogism is only one kind of deductive argument. In mathematics, which is wholly deductive, syllogisms hardly ever occur. Of course, it would be possible to rewrite mathematical arguments in syllogistic form, but this would be very artificial and would not make them any more cogent. Take arithmetic, for example. If I buy goods worth $4.63 and tender a $5 bill in payment, how much change is due to me? To put this simple sum in the form of a syllogism would be absurd and would tend to conceal the real nature of the argument. Again, within logic, there are non-syllogistic inferences, such as, a horse is an animal, therefore a horse's head is an animal's head. Valid syllogisms, in fact, are only some among valid deductions, and have no logical priority over others. The attempt to give preeminence to the syllogism in deduction misled philosophers as to the nature of mathematical reasoning. Kant, who perceived that mathematics is not syllogistic, inferred that it uses extra-logical principles, which, however, he supposed to be as certain as those of logic. He, like his predecessors, though in a different way, was misled by respect for Aristotle. 3. Overestimation of deduction. The Greeks in general attached more importance to deduction as a source of knowledge than modern philosophers do. In this respect, Aristotle was less at fault than Plato. He repeatedly admitted the importance of induction, and he devoted considerable attention to the question, how do we know the first premises from which deduction must start? Nevertheless, he, like other Greeks, gave undue prominence to deduction in his theory of knowledge. We shall agree that Mr. Smith, say, is mortal, and we may loosely say that we know this because we know that all men are mortal. But what we really know is not all men are mortal. We know rather something like all men born more than 150 years ago are mortal, and so are almost all men born more than 100 years ago. This is our reason for thinking that Mr. Smith will die. But this argument is an induction, not a deduction. It has less cogency than a deduction and yields only a probability, not a certainty. But on the other hand, it gives new knowledge, which deduction does not. All the important inferences outside logic and pure mathematics are inductive, not deductive. The only exceptions are law and theology, each of which derives its first principles from an unquestionable text, namely the statute books or the scriptures. Apart from the Prior Analytics, which deals with the syllogism, there are other writings of Aristotle which have considerable importance in the history of philosophy. One of these is the short work on the Categories. Porphyry, the Neoplatonist, wrote a commentary on this book which had a very notable influence on medieval philosophy. But for the present, let us ignore Porphyry and confine ourselves to Aristotle. What exactly is meant by the word category, whether in Aristotle or in Kant and Hegel, I must confess that I have never been able to understand. I do not myself believe that the term category is in any way useful in philosophy as representing any clear idea. There are, in Aristotle, 10 categories: substance, quantity, quality, relation, place, time, position, state, action, and affection. The only definition offered of the term category is expressions which are in no way composite signify, and then follows the above list. This seems to mean that every word of which the meaning is not compounded of the meanings of other words signifies a substance or a quantity or etc. There is no suggestion of any principle on which the list of 10 categories has been compiled. Substance is primarily what is not predicable of a subject, nor present in a subject. A thing is said to be present in a subject when, though not a part of the subject, it cannot exist without the subject. The instances given are a piece of grammatical knowledge which is present in a mind, and a certain whiteness which may be present in a body. A substance in the above primary sense is an individual thing or person or animal. But in a secondary sense, a species or a genus, for example, man or animal, may be called a substance. This secondary sense seems indefensible and opened the door in later writers to much bad metaphysics. The Posterior Analytics is a work largely concerned with a question which must trouble any deductive theory, namely, how are first premises obtained? Since deduction must start from somewhere, we must begin with something unproved, which must be known otherwise than by demonstration. I shall not give Aristotle's theory in detail, since it depends upon the notion of essence. A definition, he says, is a statement of a thing's essential nature. The notion of essence is an intimate part of every philosophy subsequent to Aristotle until we come to modern times. It is, in my opinion, a hopelessly muddle-headed notion, but its historical importance requires us to say something about it. The essence of a thing appears to have meant those of its properties which it cannot change without losing its identity. Socrates may be sometimes happy, sometimes sad, sometimes well, sometimes ill. Since he can change these properties without ceasing to be Socrates, they are no part of his essence. But it is supposed to be of the essence of Socrates that he is a man, though a Pythagorean who believes in transmigration will not admit this. In fact, the question of essence is one as to the use of words. We apply the same name on different occasions to somewhat different occurrences, which we regard as manifestations of a single thing or person. In fact, however, this is only a verbal convenience. The essence of Socrates thus consists of those properties in the absence of which we should not use the name Socrates. The question is purely linguistic. A word may have an essence, but a thing cannot. The conception of substance, like that of essence, is a transference to metaphysics of what is only a linguistic convenience. We find it convenient, in describing the world, to describe a certain number of occurrences as events in the life of Socrates, and a certain number of others as events in the life of Mr. Smith. This leads us to think of Socrates, or Mr. Smith, as denoting something that persists through a certain number of years, and as in some way more solid and real than the events that happened to him. If Socrates is ill, we think that Socrates at other times is well, and therefore the being of Socrates is independent of his illness. Illness, on the other hand, requires somebody to be ill. But although Socrates need not be ill, something must be occurring to him if he is to be considered to exist. He is not, therefore, really any more solid than the things that happen to him. Substance, when taken seriously, is a concept impossible to free from difficulties. A substance is supposed to be the subject of properties, and to be something distinct from all its properties. But when we take away the properties and try to imagine the substance by itself, we find that there is nothing left. To put the matter in another way, what distinguishes one substance from another? Not difference of properties, for according to the logic of substance, difference of properties presupposes numerical diversity between the substances concerned. Two substances, therefore, must be just two, without being in themselves in any way distinguishable. How then are we ever to find out that they are two? Substance, in fact, is merely a convenient way of collecting events into bundles. What can we know about Mr. Smith? When we look at him, we see a pattern of colours. When we listen to him talking, we hear a series of sounds. We believe that, like us, he has thoughts and feelings. But what is Mr. Smith apart from all these occurrences? A mere imaginary hook from which the occurrences are supposed to hang? They have, in fact, no need of a hook any more than the earth needs an elephant to rest upon. Anyone can see in the analogous case of a geographical region that such a word as France, say, is only a linguistic convenience, and that there is not a thing called France over and above its various parts. The same holds of Mr. Smith. It is a collective name for a number of occurrences. If we take it as anything more, it denotes something completely unknowable, and therefore not needed for the expression of what we know. Substance, in a word, is a metaphysical mistake, due to transference to the world structure of the structure of sentences composed of a subject and a predicate. I conclude that the Aristotelian doctrines with which we have been concerned in this chapter are wholly false, with the exception of the formal theory of the syllogism, which is unimportant. Any person in the present day who wishes to learn logic will be wasting his time if he reads Aristotle or any of his disciples. Nonetheless, Aristotle's logical writings show great ability and would have been useful to mankind if they had appeared at a time when intellectual originality was still active. Unfortunately, they appeared at the very end of the creative period of Greek thought, and therefore came to be accepted as authoritative. By the time that logical originality revived, a reign of 2,000 years had made Aristotle very difficult to dethrone. Throughout modern times, practically every advance in science, in logic, or in philosophy has had to be made in the teeth of the opposition from Aristotle's disciples. Chapter 23. Aristotle's Physics. In this chapter, I propose to consider two of Aristotle's books, the one called Physics and the one called On the Heavens. These two books are closely connected. The second takes up the argument at the point at which the first has left it. Both were extremely influential and dominated science until the time of Galileo. Words such as quintessence and sublunary are derived from the theories expressed in these books. The historian of philosophy, accordingly, must study them, in spite of the fact that hardly a sentence in either can be accepted in the light of modern science. To understand the views of Aristotle, as of most Greeks, on physics, it is necessary to apprehend their imaginative background. Every philosopher, in addition to the formal system which he offers to the world, has another, much simpler, of which he may be quite unaware. If he is aware of it, he probably realizes that it won't quite do. He therefore conceals it, and sets forth something more sophisticated, which he believes because it is like his crude system, but which he asks others to accept because he thinks he has made it such as cannot be disproved. Sophistication comes in by way of refutation of refutations, but this alone will never give a positive result. It shows, at best, that a theory may be true, not that it must be. The positive result, however little the philosopher may realize it, is due to his imaginative preconceptions, or to what Santayana calls animal faith. In relation to physics, Aristotle's imaginative background was very different from that of a modern student. Nowadays, a boy begins with mechanics, which by its very name suggests machines. He is accustomed to motor cars and aeroplanes. He does not, even in the dimmest recesses of his subconscious imagination, think that a motor car contains some sort of horse in its inside, or that an aeroplane flies because its wings are those of a bird possessing magical powers. Animals have lost their importance in our imaginative pictures of the world, in which man stands comparatively alone as master of a mainly lifeless and largely subservient material environment. To the Greek, attempting to give a scientific account of motion, the purely mechanical view hardly suggested itself, except in the case of a few men of genius, such as Democritus and Archimedes. Two sets of phenomena seemed important, the movements of animals and the movements of the heavenly bodies. To the modern man of science, the body of an animal is a very elaborate machine with an enormously complex physico-chemical structure. Every new discovery consists in diminishing the apparent gulf between animals and machines. To the Greek, it seemed more natural to assimilate apparently lifeless motions to those of animals. A child still distinguishes live animals from other things by the fact that they can move of themselves. To many Greeks, and especially to Aristotle, this peculiarity suggested itself as the basis of a general theory of physics. But how about the heavenly bodies? They differ from animals by the regularity of their movements, but this may only be due to their superior perfection. Every Greek philosopher, whatever he may have come to think in adult life, had been taught in childhood to regard the sun and moon as gods. Anaxagoras was prosecuted for impiety because he thought that they were not alive. It was natural that a philosopher who could no longer regard the heavenly bodies themselves as divine should think of them as moved by the will of a divine being who had a Hellenic love of order and geometrical simplicity. Thus, the ultimate source of all movement is will. On earth, the capricious will of human beings and animals, but in heaven, the unchanging will of the supreme artificer. I do not suggest that this applies to every detail of what Aristotle has to say. What I do suggest is that it gives his imaginative background and represents the sort of thing which, in embarking on his investigations, he would expect to find true. After these preliminaries, let us examine what it is that he actually says. Physics, in Aristotle, is the science of what the Greeks called physis, or physis, a word which is translated nature, but has not exactly the meaning which we attach to that word. We still speak of natural science and natural history, but nature by itself, though it is a very ambiguous word, seldom means just what physis meant. Physis had to do with growth. One might say it is the nature of an acorn to grow into an oak, and in that case, one would be using the word in the Aristotelian sense. The nature of a thing, Aristotle says, is its end, that for the sake of which it exists. Thus the word has a teleological implication. Some things exist by nature, some from other causes. Animals, plants, and simple bodies, elements, exist by nature. They have an internal principle of motion. The word translated motion or movement has a wider meaning than locomotion. In addition to locomotion, it includes change of quality or of size. Nature is a source of being moved or at rest. Things have a nature if they have an internal principle of this kind. The phrase according to nature applies to these things and their essential attributes. It was through this point of view that unnatural came to express blame. Nature is in form rather than in matter. What is potentially flesh or bone has not yet acquired its own nature, and a thing is more what it is when it has attained to fulfillment. This whole point of view seems to be suggested by biology. The acorn is potentially an oak. Nature belongs to the class of causes which operate for the sake of something. This leads to a discussion of the view that nature works of necessity, without purpose, in connection with which Aristotle discusses the survival of the fittest, in the form taught by Empedocles. This cannot be right, he says, because things happen in fixed ways, and when a series has a completion, all preceding steps are for its sake. Those things are natural which, by a continuous movement originated from an internal principle, arrive at some completion. This whole conception of nature, though it might well seem admirably suited to explain the growth of animals and plants, became in the event a great obstacle to the progress of science, and a source of much that was bad in ethics. In the latter respect, it is still harmful. Motion, we are told, is the fulfilling of what exists potentially. This view, apart from other defects, is incompatible with the relativity of locomotion. When A moves relatively to B, B moves relatively to A, and there is no sense in saying that one of the two is in motion while the other is at rest. When a dog seizes a bone, it seems to common sense that the dog moves while the bone remains at rest until seized, and that the motion has a purpose, namely to fulfill the dog's nature. But it has turned out that this point of view cannot be applied to dead matter, and that, for the purposes of scientific physics, no conception of an end is useful, nor can any motion in scientific strictness be treated as other than relative. Aristotle rejects the void, as maintained by Leucippus and Democritus. He then passes on to a rather curious discussion of time. It might, he says, be maintained that time does not exist, since it is composed of past and future, of which one no longer exists, while the other does not yet exist. This view, however, he rejects. Time, he says, is motion that admits of numeration. It is not clear why he thinks numeration essential. We may fairly ask, he continues, whether time could exist without the soul, since there cannot be anything to count unless there is someone to count, and time involves numeration. It seems that he thinks of time as so many hours or days or years. Some things, he adds, are eternal, in the sense of not being in time. Presumably he is thinking of such things as numbers. There always has been motion, and there always will be, for there cannot be time without motion, and all are agreed that time is uncreated, except Plato. On this point, Christian followers of Aristotle were obliged to dissent from him, since the Bible tells us that the universe had a beginning. The Physics ends with the argument for an unmoved mover, which we considered in connection with the Metaphysics. There is one unmoved mover which directly causes a circular motion. Circular motion is the primary kind, and the only kind which can be continuous and infinite. The first mover has no parts or magnitude, and is at the circumference of the world. Having reached this conclusion, we pass on to the heavens. The treatise On the Heavens sets forth a pleasant and simple theory. Things below the moon are subject to generation and decay. From the moon upwards, everything is ungenerated and indestructible. The earth, which is spherical, is at the center of the universe. In the sublunary sphere, everything is composed of the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire. But there is a fifth element, of which the heavenly bodies are composed. The natural movement of the terrestrial elements is rectilinear, but that of the fifth element is circular. The heavens are perfectly spherical, and the upper regions are more divine than the lower. The stars and planets are not composed of fire, but of the fifth element. Their motion is due to that of spheres to which they are attached. All this appears in poetical form in Dante's Paradiso. The four terrestrial elements are not eternal, but are generated out of each other. Fire is absolutely light, in the sense that its natural motion is upward. Earth is absolutely heavy. Air is relatively light, and water is relatively heavy. This theory provided many difficulties for later ages. Comets, which were recognized as destructible, had to be assigned to the sublunary sphere, but in the 17th century it was found that they describe orbits around the sun, and are very seldom as near as the moon. Since the natural motion of terrestrial bodies is rectilinear, it was held that a projectile fired horizontally will move horizontally for a time, and then suddenly begin to fall vertically. Galileo's discovery that a projectile moves in a parabola shocked his Aristotelian colleagues. Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo had to combat Aristotle as well as the Bible in establishing the view that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but rotates once a day and goes round the sun once a year. To come to a more general matter, Aristotelian physics is incompatible with Newton's first law of motion, originally enunciated by Galileo. This law states that every body, left to itself, will, if already in motion, continue to move in a straight line at uniform velocity. Thus, outside causes are required not to account for motion, but to account for change of motion, either in velocity or in direction. Circular motion, which Aristotle thought natural for the heavenly bodies, involves a continual change in the direction of motion, and therefore requires a force directed towards the center of the circle, as in Newton's law of gravitation. Finally, the view that the heavenly bodies are eternal and incorruptible has had to be abandoned. The sun and stars have long lives, but do not live forever. They are born from a nebula, and in the end they either explode or die of cold. Nothing in the visible world is exempt from change and decay. The Aristotelian belief to the contrary, though accepted by medieval Christians, is a product of the pagan worship of sun and moon and planets. Chapter 24. Early Greek Mathematics and Astronomy. I am concerned in this chapter with mathematics, not on its own account, but as it was related to Greek philosophy, a relation which, especially in Plato, was very close. The preeminence of the Greeks appears more clearly in mathematics and astronomy than in anything else. What they did in art, in literature, and in philosophy may be judged better or worse according to taste. But what they accomplished in geometry is wholly beyond question. They derived something from Egypt, and rather less from Babylonia. But what they obtained from these sources was, in mathematics, mainly rules of thumb, and in astronomy, records of observations extended over very long periods. The art of mathematical demonstration was almost wholly Greek in origin. There are many pleasant stories, probably unhistorical, showing what practical problems stimulated mathematical investigations. The earliest and simplest relates to Thales, who, when in Egypt, was asked by the king to find out the height of a pyramid. He waited for the time of day when his shadow was as long as he was tall. He then measured the shadow of the pyramid, which was, of course, equal to its height. It is said that the laws of perspective were first studied by the geometer Agatharchus in order to paint scenery for the plays of Aeschylus. The problem of finding the distance of a ship at sea, which was said to have been studied by Thales, was correctly solved at an early stage. One of the great problems that occupied Greek geometers, that of the duplication of the cube, originated, we are told, with the priests of a certain temple who were informed by the oracle that the god wanted a statue twice as large as the one they had. At first they thought simply of doubling all the dimensions of the statue, but then they realized that the result would be 8 times as large as the original, which would involve more expense than the god had demanded. So they sent a deputation to Plato to ask whether anybody in the academy could solve their problem. The geometers took it up and worked at it for centuries, producing, incidentally, much admirable work. The problem is, of course, that of determining the cube root of 2. The square root of 2, which was the first irrational to be discovered, was known to the early Pythagoreans, and ingenious methods of approximating to its value were discovered. The best was as follows. Form 2 columns of numbers, which we will call the A's and the B's. Each starts with 1. The next A at each stage is formed by adding the last A and B already obtained. The next B is formed by adding twice the previous A to the previous B. The first 6 pairs so obtained are 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 12, 17, 29, 41, 70, 99. In each pair, 2a squared minus b squared is 1, or minus 1. Thus, b over a is nearly the square root of 2, and at each fresh step it gets nearer. For instance, the reader may satisfy himself the square root of 99 over 70 is very nearly equal to 2. Pythagoras, always a rather misty figure, is described by Proclus as the first who made geometry a liberal education. Many authorities, including Sir Thomas Heath, believe that he probably discovered the theorem that bears his name, to the effect that, in a right-angled triangle, the square on the side opposite the right angle is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. In any case, this theorem was known to the Pythagoreans at a very early date. They knew also that the sum of the angles of a triangle is 2 right angles. Irrationals, other than the square root of 2, were studied in particular cases by Theodorus, a contemporary of Socrates, and in a more general way by Theaetetus, who was roughly contemporary with Plato but somewhat older. Democritus wrote a treatise on irrationals, but very little is known as to its contents. Plato was profoundly interested in the subject. He mentions the work of Theodorus and Theaetetus in the dialogue called after the latter. In the Laws, 819 to 820, he says that the general ignorance on this subject is disgraceful, and implies that he himself began to know about it rather late in life. It had, of course, an important bearing on the Pythagorean philosophy. One of the most important consequences of the discovery of irrationals was the invention of the geometrical theory of proportion by Eudoxus, circa 408 to circa 355 BC. Before him, there was only the arithmetical theory of proportion. According to this theory, the ratio of A to B is equal to the ratio of C to D if A times D is equal to B times C. This definition, in the absence of an arithmetical theory of irrationals, is only applicable to rationals. Eudoxus, however, gave a new definition not subject to this restriction, framed in a manner which suggests the methods of modern analysis. The theory is developed in Euclid and has great logical beauty. Eudoxus also either invented or perfected the method of exhaustion, which was subsequently used with great success by Archimedes. This method is an anticipation of the integral calculus. Take, for example, the question of the area of a circle. You can inscribe in a circle a regular hexagon, or a regular dodecagon, or a regular polygon of 1,000 or 1,000,000 sides. The area of such a polygon, however many sides it has, is proportional to the square on the diameter of the circle. The more sides the polygon has, the more nearly it becomes equal to the circle. You can prove that if you give the polygon enough sides, its area can be got to differ from that of the circle by less than any previously assigned area, however small. For this purpose, the axiom of Archimedes is used. This states, when somewhat simplified, that if the greater of two quantities is halved, and then the half is halved, and so on, a quantity will be reached at last which is less than the smaller of the original two quantities. In other words, if A is greater than B, there is some whole number n such that 2 to the power of n times B is greater than A. The method of exhaustion sometimes leads to an exact result, as in squaring the parabola, which was done by Archimedes. Sometimes, as in the attempt to square the circle, it can only lead to successive approximations. The problem of squaring the circle is the problem of determining the ratio of the circumference of a circle to the diameter, which is called pi. Archimedes used the approximation 22 divided by 7 in calculations. By inscribing and circumscribing a regular polygon of 96 sides, he proved that pi is less than 3 1/7 and greater than 3 10/71. The method could be carried to any required degree of approximation, and that is all that any method can do in this problem. The use of inscribed and circumscribed polygons for approximations to pi goes back to Antiphon, who was a contemporary of Socrates. Euclid, who was still, when I was young, the sole acknowledged textbook of geometry for boys, lived at Alexandria, about 300 BC, a few years after the death of Alexander and Aristotle. Most of his Elements was not original, but the order of propositions and the logical structure were largely his. The more one studies geometry, the more admirable these are seen to be. The treatment of parallels by means of the famous postulate of parallels has the twofold merit of rigor in deduction and of not concealing the dubiousness of the initial assumption. The theory of proportion, which follows Eudoxus, avoids all the difficulties connected with irrationals, by methods essentially similar to those introduced by Weierstrass into 19th century analysis. Euclid then passes on to a kind of geometrical algebra and deals in Book 10 with the subject of irrationals. After this, he proceeds to solid geometry, ending with the construction of the regular solids, which had been perfected by Theaetetus and assumed in Plato's Timaeus. Euclid's Elements is certainly one of the greatest books ever written, and one of the most perfect monuments of the Greek intellect. It has, of course, the typical Greek limitations. The method is purely deductive, and there is no way within it of testing the initial assumptions. These assumptions were supposed to be unquestionable, but in the 19th century, non-Euclidean geometry showed that they might be in part mistaken, and that only observation could decide whether they were so. There is in Euclid the contempt for practical utility which had been inculcated by Plato. It is said that a pupil, after listening to a demonstration, asked what he would gain by learning geometry, whereupon Euclid called a slave and said, "Give the young man 3 pence, since he must needs make a gain out of what he learns." The contempt for practice was, however, pragmatically justified. No one in Greek times supposed that conic sections had any utility. At last, in the 17th century, Galileo discovered that projectiles move in parabolas, and Kepler discovered that planets move in ellipses. Suddenly, the work that the Greeks had done from pure love of theory became the key to warfare and astronomy. The Romans were too practical-minded to appreciate Euclid. The first of them to mention him is Cicero, in whose time there was probably no Latin translation. Indeed, there is no record of any Latin translation before Boethius, circa AD 480. The Arabs were more appreciative. A copy was given to the Caliph by the Byzantine Emperor about AD 760, and a translation into Arabic was made under Harun al-Rashid about AD 800. The first still extant Latin translation was made from the Arabic by Athelhard of Bath in AD 1120. From that time on, the study of geometry gradually revived in the West, but it was not until the late Renaissance that important advances were made. I come now to astronomy, where Greek achievements were as remarkable as in geometry. Before their time, among the Babylonians and Egyptians, many centuries of observation had laid a foundation. The apparent motions of the planets had been recorded, but it was not known that the morning and evening star were the same. A cycle of eclipses had been discovered, certainly in Babylonia and probably in Egypt, which made the prediction of lunar eclipses fairly reliable, but not of solar eclipses, since those were not always visible at a given spot. We owe to the Babylonians the division of the right angle into 90 degrees and of the degree into 60 minutes. They had a liking for the number 60, and even a system of numeration based upon it. The Greeks were fond of attributing the wisdom of their pioneers to travels in Egypt, but what had really been achieved before the Greeks was very little. The prediction of an eclipse by Thales was, however, an example of foreign influence. There is no reason to suppose that he added anything to what he learnt from Egyptian or Babylonian sources, and it was a stroke of luck that his prediction was verified. Let us begin with some of the earliest discoveries and correct hypotheses. Anaximander thought that the earth floats freely and is not supported on anything. Aristotle, who often rejected the best hypotheses of his time, objected to the theory of Anaximander that the earth, being at the centre, remained immovable because there was no reason for moving in one direction rather than another. If this were valid, he said, a man placed at the centre of a circle with food at various points of the circumference would starve to death for lack of reason to choose one portion of food rather than another. This argument reappears in scholastic philosophy, not in connection with astronomy, but with free will. It reappears in the form of Buridan's ass, which was unable to choose between two bundles of hay placed at equal distances to right and left, and therefore died of hunger. Pythagoras, in all probability, was the first to think the earth spherical, but his reasons were, one must suppose, aesthetic rather than scientific. Scientific reasons, however, were soon found. Anaxagoras discovered that the moon shines by reflected light and gave the right theory of eclipses. He himself still thought the earth flat, but the shape of the earth's shadow in lunar eclipses gave the Pythagoreans conclusive arguments in favor of its being spherical. They went further and regarded the earth as one of the planets. They knew, from Pythagoras himself, it is said, that the morning star and the evening star are identical. And they thought that all the planets, including the earth, move in circles, not round the sun, but round the central fire. They had discovered that the moon always turns the same face to the earth, and they thought that the earth always turns the same face to the central fire. The Mediterranean regions were on the side turned away from the central fire, which was therefore always invisible. The central fire was called the House of Zeus, or the Mother of the Gods. The sun was supposed to shine by light reflected from the central fire. In addition to the earth, there was another body, the counter-earth, at the same distance from the central fire. For this, they had two reasons, one scientific, one derived from their arithmetical mysticism. The scientific reason was the correct observation that an eclipse of the moon sometimes occurs when both sun and moon are above the horizon. Refraction, which is the cause of this phenomenon, was unknown to them, and they thought that, in such cases, the eclipse must be due to the shadow of a body other than the earth. The other reason was that the sun and moon, the five planets, the earth and counter-earth, and the central fire made 10 heavenly bodies, and 10 was the mystic number of the Pythagoreans. This Pythagorean theory is attributed to Philolaus, a Theban, who lived at the end of the 5th century BC. Although it is fanciful and in part quite unscientific, it is very important, since it involves the greater part of the imaginative effort required for conceiving the Copernican hypothesis. To conceive of the Earth, not as the centre of the universe, but as one among the planets, not as eternally fixed, but as wandering through space, showed an extraordinary emancipation from anthropocentric thinking. When once this jolt had been given to men's natural picture of the universe, it was not so very difficult to be led by scientific arguments to a more accurate theory. To this, various observations contributed. Inopides, who was slightly later than Anaxagoras, discovered the obliquity of the ecliptic. It soon became clear that the sun must be much larger than the earth, which in fact supported those who denied that the earth is the center of the universe. The central fire and the counter-earth were dropped by the Pythagoreans soon after the time of Plato. Heraclides of Pontus, whose dates are about 388 to 315 BC, contemporary with Aristotle, discovered that Venus and Mercury revolve about the Sun, and adopted the view that the Earth rotates on its own axis once every 24 hours. This last was a very important step, which no predecessor had taken. Heraclides was of Plato's school and must have been a great man, but was not as much respected as one would expect. He is described as a fat dandy. Aristarchus of Samos, who lived approximately from 310 to 230 BC and was thus about 25 years older than Archimedes, is the most interesting of all ancient astronomers, because he advanced the complete Copernican hypothesis that all the planets, including the Earth, revolve in circles around the Sun, and that the Earth rotates on its axis once in 24 hours. It is a little disappointing to find that the only extant work of Aristarchus on the sizes and distances of the Sun and the Moon adheres to the geocentric view. It is true that, for the problems with which this book deals, it makes no difference which theory is adopted, and he may therefore have thought it unwise to burden his calculations with an unnecessary opposition to the general opinion of astronomers. Or he may have only arrived at the Copernican hypothesis after writing this book. Sir Thomas Heath, in his work on Aristarchus, which contains the text of this book with a translation, inclines to the latter view. The evidence that Aristarchus suggested the Copernican view is in any case quite conclusive. The first and best evidence is that of Archimedes, who, as we have seen, was a younger contemporary of Aristarchus. Writing to Gelon, king of Syracuse, he says that Aristarchus brought out a book consisting of certain hypotheses, and continues, "His hypotheses are that the fixed stars and the sun remain unmoved, that the earth revolves about the sun in the circumference of a circle, the sun lying in the middle of the orbit." There is a passage in Plutarch saying that Cleanthes thought it was the duty of the Greeks to indict Aristarchus of Samos on the charge of impiety for putting in motion the half of the universe, that is, the earth, this being the effect of his attempt to save the phenomena by supposing the heaven to remain at rest and the earth to revolve in an oblique circle, while it rotates, at the same time, about its own axis. Cleanthes was a contemporary of Aristarchus and died about 232 BC. In another passage, Plutarch says that Aristarchus advanced this view only as a hypothesis, but that his successor, Seleucus, maintained it as a definite opinion. Seleucus flourished about 150 BC. Aetius and Sextus Empiricus also assert that Aristarchus advanced the heliocentric hypothesis, but do not say that it was set forth by him only as a hypothesis. Even if he did so, it seems not unlikely that he, like Galileo 2,000 years later, was influenced by the fear of offending religious prejudices, a fear which the attitude of Cleanthes, mentioned above, shows to have been well grounded. The Copernican hypothesis, after being advanced, whether positively or tentatively, by Aristarchus, was definitely adopted by Seleucus, but by no other ancient astronomer. This general rejection was mainly due to Hipparchus, who flourished from 161 to 126 BC. He is described by Heath as the greatest astronomer of antiquity. He was the first to write systematically on trigonometry. He discovered the precession of the equinoxes. He estimated the length of the lunar month with an error of less than 1 second. He improved Aristarchus's estimates of the sizes and distances of the sun and moon. He made a catalogue of 850 fixed stars, giving their latitude and longitude. As against the heliocentric hypothesis of Aristarchus, he adopted and improved the theory of epicycles, which had been invented by Apollonius, who flourished about 220 BC. It was a development of this theory that came to be known later as the Ptolemaic system, after the astronomer Ptolemy, who flourished in the middle of the 2nd century AD. Copernicus came to know something, though not much, of the almost forgotten hypothesis of Aristarchus, and was encouraged by finding ancient authority for his innovation. Otherwise, the effect of this hypothesis on subsequent astronomy was practically nil. Ancient astronomers, in estimating the sizes of the Earth, Moon, and Sun, and the distances of the Moon and Sun, used methods which were theoretically valid, but they were hampered by the lack of instruments of precision. Many of their results, in view of this lack, were surprisingly good. Eratosthenes estimated the Earth's diameter at 7,850 miles, which is only about 50 miles short of the truth. Ptolemy estimated the mean distance of the moon at 29.5 times the Earth's diameter. The correct figure is about 30.2. None of them got anywhere near the size and distance of the sun, which all underestimated. Their estimates in terms of the Earth's diameter were Aristarchus, 180, Hipparchus, 1,245, Posidonius, 6,545. The correct figure is 11,726. It will be seen that these estimates continually improved. That of Ptolemy, however, showed a retrogression. That of Posidonius is about half the correct figure. Footnote: Posidonius was Cicero's teacher. He flourished in the latter half of the 2nd century BC. End of footnote. On the whole, their picture of the solar system was not so very far from the truth. Greek astronomy was geometrical, not dynamic. The ancients thought of the motions of the heavenly bodies as uniform and circular, or compounded of circular motions. They had not the conception of force. There were spheres which moved as a whole, and on which the various heavenly bodies were fixed. With Newton and gravitation, a new point of view, less geometrical, was introduced. It is curious to observe that there is a reversion to the geometrical point of view in Einstein's general theory of relativity, from which the conception of force, in the Newtonian sense, has been banished. The problem for the astronomer is this. Given the apparent motions of the heavenly bodies on the celestial sphere, to introduce, by hypothesis, a third coordinate, depth, in such a way as to make the description of the phenomena as simple as possible. The merit of the Copernican hypothesis is not truth, but simplicity. In view of the relativity of motion, no question of truth is involved. The Greeks, in their search for hypotheses which would save the phenomena, were in effect, though not altogether in intention, tackling the problem in the scientifically correct way. A comparison with their predecessors and with their successors until Copernicus must convince every student of their truly astonishing genius. Two very great men, Archimedes and Apollonius in the 3rd century BC, complete the list of first-class Greek mathematicians. Archimedes was a friend, probably a cousin of the king of Syracuse, and was killed when that city was captured by the Romans in 212 BC. Apollonius, from his youth, lived at Alexandria. Archimedes was not only a mathematician, but also a physicist and student of hydrostatics. Apollonius is chiefly noted for his work on conic sections.